Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill Redway, and this is the Red Satin programme for the week ending Saturday, 15th June 2019. The music I'm playing today is called The Honeybee Slip Jig by Carida, a trio comprising harp, fiddle and double bass. It's from an album put together by Rowan Piggott, who plays fiddle on this track, and it's a collection of songs and tunes about bees and the perilous state of the bee population, which is such a vital part of our ecology. The album is called Song Hive, and as usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, after which Peter Burley reports on the upcoming International Organ Festival. We follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days. Courtesy of Sue, once again. In part two, Rob is in conversation with Sian Tomlinson, CEO of Mind in Mid-Hearts. And in part three, local author of fiction for children, Camilla Chester, discusses Wolf Hall, the first of Hilary Mantel's planned trilogy about Thomas Cromwell. We start with the news, and our readers today are Anna, Jenny, Martin, and Lucy.
Hello, I'm Anna, and my first piece is entitled Major Blaze on College Campus. A police investigation is ongoing following a large fire at Oakland's College in St Albans. 8 fire engines were called to Oakland's College St Albans campus on Hatfield Road shortly after midday on Friday, after a large section of cladding in the Discovery Centre caught alight. Firefighters used 2 jets and 2 sets of breathing apparatus to extinguish the blaze, while police prevented vehicles from entering the grounds. All staff and students were safely evacuated, and lessons were cancelled for the afternoon. 3 teenagers from Welwyn Garden City, 2 girls aged 16 and 17, and a 17-year-old boy were arrested later that day on suspicion of arson, but have been released under police investigation. Oakland's College principal, Zoe Hancock, said, "We can confirm that the fire and police services have handed the Discovery Centre building back to us after the fire on Friday. The building is being assessed this morning by our insurance company to determine the damage and the next steps. The fire services have confirmed that the fire compartmentalisation was effective and that there is limited damage to the building. We are aware that due to water damage, our sports halls will require a new floor. We're at present making plans for student lessons that have been affected until the end of term, and most importantly, that all exams go ahead as planned. On behalf of the college, I would like to thank the fire and public teams who've helped and supported us through this incident. The Oakland Summer Fair on Sunday went ahead as planned, and the college is open as usual this week."
Hello, I'm Jenny, and my first article is about the NHS. NHS bosses submit hospitals' renovation options. NHS bosses are likely to back a major redevelopment of Watford General Hospital, while local campaigners continue to fight for a new hospital central to St Albans, Watford and Decorum. West Hearts Hospital Trust and Hearts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group held a joint meeting on Thursday, June 6th, where they chose submitting a £350 million bid to improve existing hospital sites as their preferred way forward. The Trust previously ruled out building a new central hospital after being given a £350 million spending limit and will instead invest in Watford General while retaining and improving services at both St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead hospitals. Under the preferred proposal, known as Option 1, there will be 2 new clinical buildings on the Vicarage Road site in Watford, incorporating a new theatre suite, a new women's and children's unit, and a new ward block. The existing Princess Michael of Kent building would be refurbished, and there would be a purpose-built car park with a portion of land at the site sold off for housing. St Albans City Hospital would be enhanced as a planned surgical facility, including a new cancer and surgical centre with a diagnostic suite. There would also be refurbishments to theatres and inpatient beds, and the development of a small high-dependency unit. Meanwhile, Hemel Hempstead Hospital would become a planned medical centre with services consolidated into a redeveloped complex, which would include a new urgent treatment centre. Local campaigners, however, are arguing that a new hospital should still be considered and would be in a more accessible location and with improved facilities to better serve a growing population. Edie Glatter, a member of the New Hospital Campaign Steering Group, described the money going to Watford General as a short-term fix, which will quickly unravel. She said, "The patients throughout West Hertfordshire will accelerate their exodus to other neighbouring hospitals over the decade or more that this challenging and hazardous rebuilding process is in train. The large injection of money into Watford Hospital won't even give us facilities up to present-day NHS standards, let alone ones fit for the future, and will leave St Albans and Hemel Hempstead hospitals with barely anything worthwhile." Fellow campaigner Andy Love, who lives in St Albans, said, "Simply discarding a new hospital as unaffordable without full evaluation and identifying a specific site is irrational and suggests it was an option that both boards were never interested in." On July the 11th, the West Harts Hospital Trust board will make their decision on the option to be submitted for investment at a specially convened public meeting. Later that day, Harts Valley's Clinical Commissioning Group will meet to consider the trust decision and reach their own conclusion. Local people will be invited to make representations at both board meetings, and the final submission for funding will be made in the summer, in time for consideration in the government's comprehensive spending review.
Hello, my name is Martin, and my first feature has this headline. An event was held in Harbenden recently to celebrate campaigner Emily Ketchin being crowned this town's, I quote, "most inspirational," unquote, woman. Emily, who is chair of Harbenden Commuters Group, was named the winner of hashtag SheInspires 2019, organised by Harpenden photographer Penny Bird for her work campaigning to improve the train service. The search to find Harpenden's most inspirational woman was held in honour of International Women's Day, and Emily received 6 separate nominations and 60% of the votes. Emily's campaign work was celebrated at the Park Cafe, where Harpenden resident Giles Crute spoke about her achievements. These include leading the most supported petition in the history of St Albans District Council, which called for effective action, giving evidence to the Transport Select Committee in Parliament, and taking the campaign to the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5 and Sky News. Emily thanked everyone for their support and said, "The impact of Thames Link's decision to reduce Harpenden trains by 30% without consultation has had a hugely adverse effect not only on commuters and their places of work, but on our support network of family and local business. It's been a personal and financial blow for everyone and is simply not acceptable." Other nominees for the award were reception teacher Kim Brougham, Councillor Mary Maynard, business owner Esther Hawthorne, and late MenCap charity founder Julie Fried, CBE, who was represented by her granddaughter Emily Downs. Care worker Janet Crawley, who was voted Harpenden's most inspirational woman in 2018, also attended the event to support this year's nominees. Penny Bird said, "It has been such an honour to meet and work with Emily over the last few weeks. She's an amazing inspiration to me and all the people around her."
Hello, this is Lucy, and my article reflects on D-Day. HMS St Albans led a Royal British Legion ship in a salute last week to mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day landings at Normandy, with a Harts military historian sharing the experience alongside veterans who served. On the evening of Wednesday, June the 5th, the eve of the anniversary of the landings, HMS St Albans led a ship from Portsmouth carrying more than 250 D-Day veterans. The ship then embarked to Normandy, mimicking the voyage in 1944 with an escort from HMS St Albans and four smaller Royal Navy vessels. Other ships docked alongside to pay their respects, and members of the public lined up at key vantage points to wave off the veterans as they retraced their journey from 75 years ago. Military historian Dan Hill, project coordinator for Hearts at War, which has been commemorating the diverse experiences of the county in the First World War, was aboard the Boudicca with the veterans on their voyage from Portsmouth to Normandy. He said, "We spent a week visiting various destinations, including Portsmouth and Normandy itself, and took part in all the commemorations along the way. It was fantastic. It really was a unique opportunity. 75 years on, the number of veterans is dwindling by the week, and to be there with the largest group of veterans that there probably ever will be now is something that was a real source of pride and something I was very grateful to be part of." On the voyage, Dan met world leaders, including outgoing Prime Minister Theresa May, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Donald Trump. He said, "All three came in and spent some real quality time talking to the veterans and thanking them for their service. No matter what people's political affiliations are, I respect the fact that they took the time to do that." Dan also got to meet the veterans, all over 90 years old, and hear their stories. He said, "Myself and the other historians got to spend time chatting to a huge number of veterans to hear their own experiences and reflections on the event as a whole." Royal British Legion National President Lieutenant General James Bashill said, "From the beginning of planning these commemorations, it has been the Legion's guiding principle to ensure our Normandy veterans are treated with the honour, dignity and respect they deserve." And there's a great picture of HMS St Albans leading the ship Boudicca out of Portsmouth Harbour to Normandy, flanked on either side by all of the harbour buildings and with its escort of Royal Navy vessels, echoing that original and very momentous military operation that took place 75 years ago.
Now, royal recognition given to stalwarts of our community, of which there are quite a number, and this is about extraordinary people from around the district and county having been recognised by the Queen for their outstanding achievements. This year's Queen's Birthday Honours, awarded to people who've gone above and beyond in their respective fields, have been announced, and there are several people from this area who made the list. The Countess of Verulam, Dione Angela Grimston, has been made a CVO. She was the first woman to be Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, has received an honorary degree from the University of Hertfordshire, and is the patron of local charities Home Start Hearts and Youth Talk. She founded the Gormbury Group and is involved in running the Gormbury Estate, including penning and illustrating the Gormbury Gardens Guide. Arhag Housing Association Chair Quadia Kiani has been made an OBE for helping migrants and refugees, as has Magistrate Nicholas Moss for services to the Administration of Justice in Hertfordshire. Harpenden golfer Kenneth Brown has been made an MBE for services to sport and broadcasting. In an interview with Hertfordshire Life, Kenneth said his success story began at the Harpenden Common Golf Club and working as an assistant pro golfer at Verulam Golf Club in St Albans. He has won four European Tour wins and had five appearances at the Ryder Cup. Bob Pepper has been made an OBE, having been made an MBE in 2005 for services to music. The 68-year-old Harpenden resident has helped young people using music education through organisations such as the Music in Secondary Schools Trust and the Enfield Youth Symphony Orchestra. He said, "I feel honoured and excited. It is great to be recognised for the work you've done. Music is a tremendous vehicle for helping kids in all sorts of ways. It encourages and helps them to work with others. It is intellectually demanding. It is lots of fun. It provides emotional relief and gives them a sense of community. Lots of kids I work with do not have the best of backgrounds, and it helps them to find a community in a good way rather than a bad way. The musical director of St Albans Chamber Choir, John Gibbons, was awarded a BEM for his services to choral music. He is a conductor, composer, arranger, pianist and organist who's been an advocate of 20th century British music and supportive of young soloists at the start of their careers. John said, "I'm completely amazed. I never expected to get anything like this, and it came as a complete surprise. Music is one of the greatest things we have in our lives, and creativity is crucial going forward for all of humanity." He described the St Albans Chamber Choir as a dedicated group of singers who undertake an adventurous repertoire. Others made MBEs include the Executive Assistant at the Ministry of Defence, Jacqueline Ida Clark, for services to Defence, Bedfordshire, Cambridge and Hertfordshire Joint Protective Services Major Crime Unit Review Team Manager, Michael Oliver Flavin, for services to policing in Hearts, and London North West Healthcare NHS Trust Macmillan Nurse Consultant Gillian Clare Taylor for services to colorectal cancer nursing in St Albans. The head of Libraries and Heritage Service in Hertfordshire, St Albans man Andrew Bignall, is also being awarded a BEM for services to public libraries in St Albans after decades in the profession. Andrew said, "I'm rather overwhelmed to be recognised in this way. It really is unexpected. I passionately believe in the power of public libraries to enrich and improve people's lives. I've always done my best to deliver high-quality services in any job I've had, but I've never thought of myself as the medal-winning type." Hertfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member of Education, Libraries and Localism, Councillor Terry Duris, said Andrew's authenticity, integrity and commitment have shone through his leadership. Under Andrew, Hertfordshire Libraries were some of the first in the country to have self-service and Wi-Fi across all sites. Head of Resources Defence Intelligence, Gary Nigel Lewitt, has been made a CEB, a CBE, for services to defence in Hertfordshire, alongside the former chief executive of the pensions regulator, Leslie Jane Titcombe, who has been made a CBE for services to pension regulation in the county. And there are pictures of three of these illustrious people. One is of Lady Verulam receiving her honorary degree in a suitable kind of formal robe. One is of Bob Pepper, and another is of John Gibbons, the musical director, who's been awarded the BEM for his choral music.
In the footsteps of travellers, soldiers and herdsmen, two local hospice charities are set to benefit from the fundraising efforts of a group of St Albans dads. One of the fathers, Trevor Meriden, explained, "Garden Fields Cricket Club, also known as Men of Fields, or MOF for short, is a collection of dads with children at Gardenfield School in St Albans. We undertake a large charitable walk together every 2 years, and early July 2019 will see our third event in the series. The two local charities that will benefit are both dear to our hearts, Rennie Grove Hospice Care and the Hospice of St Francis, and whatever funds we raise will be divided evenly between them. We have raised over £60,000 in all our pursuits to date, and now we want to do more. Our 2019 event is the 85-mile Ridgeway Walk. It follows a route used since prehistoric times by travellers, herdsmen and soldiers. This walk is dedicated to the friends and families of MOFs who have been affected by cancer and all those living with cancer everywhere. A walk starts in Liddington, near the Marlborough Downs in Wiltshire, and passes through ancient landscapes, through downland, secluded valleys and woodland onto Ivinghoe Beacon. We will then continue for another 16 miles and end in St Albans," he added. Gemma Ralph, senior community fundraiser at Rennie Grove, said, "It's because of fantastic supporters like Men of Fields that we are able to continue providing nursing and support services to local patients and their families. We're so pleased they're supporting local hospice charities this year, and we wish them well on their 85-mile walk." Claire Jones, Challenge Events fundraiser at the Hospice of St. Francis, added, "We're so impressed by and grateful to the men of Fields for supporting both us and Rennie Grove and helping us to help more local patients and families to live their precious lives well in this, our 40th birthday year. We'll be with them in spirit every step of the way and wish them the very best of luck for their epic walk." And there's a picture of the men of Fields, nine of them, who are walking along the 85-mile Ridgeway Walk. And they're all dressed in their walking boots and their shorts, and they're all looking quite tanned and cheery. I think they probably got to Ivanhoe Beacon by the looks of it.
The 38th annual St Albans Half Marathon was another stomping success. Thousands of people thronged to Verulamium Park on Sunday to take part in and watch this year's event, which has raised an estimated £17,000 to £20,000 for various local causes and groups. Runners could choose between a 13.1-mile walking, running or wheelchair course, a 5K around Verulamium Lake, or a 1.5-mile fun run for children. The fastest entrance was Paul Adams, who completed the half marathon in 1 hour, 13 minutes and 28 seconds. The quickest woman was Rachel Felton, with a time of 1 hour, 19 minutes and 49 seconds. Event director Martin Day said, "It went really well. The weather turned out lovely, despite the forecast, and it was a great day with a massive attendance." Founder of the event, Phil Gibson, once again completed the 13.1-mile route, as he has for 38 years. St Albans Half Marathon's main charity this year was Peace Hospice Care. One running team was made up of 11 staff and residents from Booper's Tenterden House in Brickett Wood, who were returning to the event for the third year running. Elizabeth Barber was part of the team, despite having suffered a life-changing stroke in August of 2016. She was left paralysed and unable to speak, and medics feared that she would never recover. However, after extensive treatment at Tenterden House, Elizabeth felt strong enough to walk the route in 2018 and again this year. She had been a keen runner before the stroke, having completed three more marathons since her first at the age of 58. She said, "After my stroke, I was just lucky to be alive. When it began to dawn on me I wouldn't complete another race, I was devastated. Running was such a big part of my life, and so to have the thrill of crossing a finishing line once again was really, really special." Fellow resident Josephine Stern from Booper's Brickett Wood Care Home in Allington Court also joined the team after recovering from a broken hip. Deputy Manager for Tenterden House Delia Adams said, "Seeing the determination in Elizabeth's eyes last year really inspired her fellow residents to give it a go. We also managed to get more of our fantastic nurses on board to join us at the race."
A story now about a St Albans man dealing with a diagnosis of bowel cancer and facing his fear of snakes to raise money and awareness of the disease. Crispin Marden of St Stephen's Avenue was diagnosed with bowel cancer in January and wanted to undertake a challenge to help people with his condition. The 59-year-old teamed up with his godson, Richard Simmons, who works for Bowel and Cancer Research, to take on the charity's I've Got Guts challenge. The challenge was set up in April to coincide with Bowel Cancer Awareness Month, encouraging people to do something daring for the cause. Together, Crispin and Richard faced two pythons and a boa constrictor at Snakes Alive Reptile Centre in Essex, raising a total of £3,265 for charity so far. Richard, who is a corporate partnerships officer for Bowel and Cancer Research, described how the staff at the centre started by getting them both to handle a few grass snakes, but gradually the snakes got bigger and bigger. He said, "When they brought out two pythons called Monty and Charlotte, we thought that was it. But then they walked in with this 10-foot boa constrictor and wrapped it around our necks. I was in flat panic when we arrived. Now, well, I wouldn't volunteer to jump into a snake pit, but I'm not as scared as I was. Speaking about the experience, Crispin said, "My heart rate went through the roof to start with. I was surprised the snakes weren't cold and slimy. They felt like warm leather shoes. I'm not sure I enjoyed the experience, but I'm glad I've done it." Crispin is undergoing treatment for bowel cancer, which was discovered by chance after a routine visit to his GP. As well as raising money, Crispin and Richard want to raise awareness and encourage people not to ignore the symptoms for fear of going to the doctor. Richard hopes people will get checked out if they're in any way concerned, adding, "It might seem terrifying to go to the GP, but it could save your life." More than 41,000 people are diagnosed with bowel cancer each year in the UK, making it the second most prevalent cancer. It's one of the most treatable cancers, if caught early. And there's quite an amusing picture of Crispin and Richard handling a python. I think it's a python. I'm not sure if it's Monty or if it's Charlotte. Crispin is looking very worried, I have to say. Richard's looking a bit calmer, but I think we can definitely say that they're both being very brave.
Here's another heartwarming story entitled 8-Year-Old Boy's Cycle Ride in Memory of Dad He Never Met. A St Albans 8-Year-Old is taking a 10-mile charity cycle in tribute to his father who died before he was born. Ollie Higman Hall is cycling 10 miles via the Auburn Way to raise money for Cardiac Risk in the Young, CRY for short, a charity which aims to prevent sudden death in young people because of undiagnosed heart conditions. Ollie's dad, Darren Hall, passed away at 30 years old when Ollie's mother, Kirsty, was just 9 weeks pregnant. He was a seemingly fit and healthy man who had a rare disease called arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. Despite Kirsty's attempts to resuscitate him, Darren died on his way to Wellington City's QE2 hospital. Kirsty said she had help from St Albans and District Bereavement Network. "I don't want to get it wrong. I don't want to tell Ollie something that isn't right, but we are very honest with him," she said. "He knows about what happened, and it is a saviour in a way to have Ollie. I had to focus on him and not let it stop us doing anything and fight for everything we do. You get out of life what you put in, and I put in everything I have. It was horrendous at the time, but we have got through it and reach out. I reach out to anyone I could." Kirsty is now remarried to Tim Higman, and Ollie has a 4-year-old half-brother called Theo. Tim will accompany Theo along half of Ollie's charity ride, and Kirsty will be with Ollie for the full route. Kirsty added, "Ollie is so excited. He asks every morning how the charity page is doing. It's 10 years ago next year since he died, and Ollie wants to remember his dad. He obviously never knew his dad, and he struggles with that because he's so like his dad. He is so sunny with people. Everyone adores him because he's a wonderful young man. Wherever he goes, he will chat to everyone." The Gardenfields JMI school pupil has already raised £750 for CRY. Chief Executive of CRY, Dr. Stephen Cox, said, "I find it so humbling that people such as Kirsty and Ollie, who've lost both their husband and dad, are able to see beyond their own horrendous experience to raise awareness of the work we do here at CRY, whether screening, research or bereavement support. Their fundraising efforts will play a vital part in helping to pave... in helping to prevent other families from having to endure the same devastating grief as they have."
Saints go marching on to finish fifth prostate cancer fundraiser. Torrential rain and high winds buffeted a team of St Albans City FC cyclists on their annual charity ride to the Netherlands. This was the fifth year the Saints have taken part in the Football to Amsterdam ride in aid of Prostate Cancer UK, travelling from the Velo Park in Stratford and finishing at the Johan Cruyff Arena. The team of 25 were the third largest of the 220 on the ride and included supporters from Swindon, Poole and Birmingham, as well as many local riders, two of whom have been diagnosed and treated for prostate cancer. The first day's route followed an 80-mile route in heavy downpours through Essex to the coast at Harwich. After an overnight ferry journey to the Hook of Holland, the route took the team on a much flatter 65-mile route, with the weather still unfavourable. The team raised money through collections at both the club's home games and the Legends game, street and train station collections, quiz and race nights, individual supporters and corporate sponsorship from many local companies. The team's fundraising has reached 40,000 in this year's ride, and a total in excess of 145,000 over all five rides. Additionally, many of the club supporters who have previously taken part will be taking part in this year's Jeff Stelling March for Men in September. Team captain Phil Coates said, "The route from the Olympic Velo Park in Stratford, East London, through the early morning traffic was testing enough, without the heavy downpours that we cycled through on the first morning and into the afternoon. After a bright start the following day, the route from the Hook of Holland along cycle tracks and through the Dutch countryside to the Johan Cruyff Arena in Amsterdam saw us buffeted by heavy rain and swirling wind." Saints co-owner, Lawrence Levy, who took part in the ride, added, "I must say that this year's ride was the toughest yet. Swirling heavy winds and torrential rain meant that it wasn't the easiest of rides. Having said that, the pain we experienced is nothing compared with those people who are affected by prostate cancer. In fact, we had a hero in our team. Paul Dando is currently going through radiotherapy for his own prostate cancer diagnosis. He trained really hard to be able to do it and showed such resilience that no one could really complain about the weather. Every time we were hit by some wind or downpour, we only had to remind ourselves of what we were doing it for. This made it easier. The Dutch leg at times was no better. Although flat, we were hit by severe hail and crosswinds, but getting to Amsterdam and completing the challenge felt satisfying. This year's total of 40K will go a long way to fund PSA testing and awareness campaigns, and it also increases our total contribution to the charity to 145K. Amazing. There we are, the Saints.
Another campaign story now, and an example of what one can achieve if you put your mind to it. It features this time Stacey Turner. Tomorrow sees mental health awareness campaigner Stacey Turner embark upon her fundraising trek to the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro with the support of dozens of local businesses. The 40-year-old children's book author and anxiety specialist is tackling the challenge with the dual aim of highlighting her It's OK to Say campaign and raising funds for Cancer Research UK. She launched the initiative in partnership with the Hearts Advertiser last October to encourage people of all ages to speak out about mental illness, confide in others, and surround themselves with supportive networks. And she has just finished applying for charity status. Stacey told the Hearts ad why she has decided to tackle Africa's highest mountain. "I've always wanted to climb Kilimanjaro for personal accomplishment after many adversities. It's one of the world's greatest natural wonders and offers the challenge to provide hope where there is despair. Meaning if I can conquer Kilimanjaro, you can accomplish anything." Today, the summit is called Uhuru Peak. Uhuru is the Swahili word for freedom. It is said to be the roof of Africa, offering inspiration for new beginning where what seemed impossible in your life might just be doable. The St. Albans mother of two daughters said that she was inspired to climb the 16,000 feet mountain after watching the 2009 Comic Relief Ascent. And she will be accompanied by her friend Claire Delaney, who works as a fundraiser manager for Cancer Research UK. She added, "I'm feeling anxious. The anxiety I feel is heaviness in my chest. I feel nervous, shaky, and emotional. I think I have been running on nervous energy. I'm overwhelmed with the support that I have received. I keep bursting into tears. I can't believe that all these people, they're just so wonderful. I've been touched by everyone's generosity, their kind and beautiful and supportive words, and their belief in me. I've just wanted to make sure everything is organised and sorted, not only for the trip, but while I'm away, so I know everything is okay. I'm nervous about leaving my girls. I keep squishing them for longer. I have made recordings for them to play every day. I've created a message jar where I have written a daily positive message.
A heartwarming story now of a St Albans tailor who has received royal recognition in the Queen's Birthday Honours 2019. Geoffrey Golding, the owner of G.D. Golding in Hatfield Road, has been awarded a Royal Victorian Order, recognising personal service to the monarch. At 75 years old, he still works 60-hour weeks and has tailored six leading members of the royal family over three decades. Geoffrey said he was shocked, humbled and overwhelmed. Awards protocol forbids me from naming which members of the royal family I serve, but I will say that it's been an honour and always a pleasure to fulfil their requirements whenever called upon. Suffering from dyslexia and having left school without qualifications, Geoffrey set up the shop in 1963 at 19 years old. He now employs 15 people. A major step forward from local to national recognition came in 1978 when Geoffrey won an appointment to make officers' uniforms for the Household Cavalry. He said, "Those officers appreciate the quality of our services, military and civilian, and stay with us when they leave the armed services and move into other important roles. Their endorsement has helped build us a reputation in the city, in the wider business world, in the civil service and in politics, including former prime ministers." Other customers have included MPs and lords, high sheriffs, a chairman of an international holiday cruise line, and a chairman of the stock exchange. Geoffrey said, "My father, who died in 1975, would have marvelled at what I've achieved. He was born in 1896, the youngest of 13 children born to a cabinet maker who fled to this country, to the East End, from persecution in Russia about 20 years before that. So my father's own horizons were limited, but he was well respected. Soon after he moved to St Albans, he worked for a while as a porter in the Lion's Corner House, which is where he met my mother, a nippy waitress. He thanked his employees. They include tailors and seamstresses who have been with us for over 25 years. The staff's loyalty and skills, so hard to find nowadays, have been crucial to our progress. We are eternally grateful for their contribution." Geoffrey has two sons and three grandchildren. And there's a lovely picture of Geoffrey looking very dapper in a pinstripe suit with a tape measure around his neck. And next to him is a beautiful red, black and gold Household Cavalry uniform.
Now something quite different, airplane noise. Luton's Airport's first quarterly monitoring report of 2019 shows an increase in noise complaints from this time last year. A total of 2,793 complaints were received in the first quarter of the year from 121 individuals, which is an average of 23 complaints per person. During the same period in 2018, the airport received 1,310 complaints from 111 individuals at an average of 11 complaints per person. Passenger numbers also increased by 12% compared to the same time last year. The report also showed that 88% of all complaints were made by just 10 residents, and only 34 came from residents who had not contacted the airport before. As part of its five-year noise action plan, the airport is holding regular public surgery events for residents and invests £100,000 a year on insulating properties against aircraft noise in hearts and beds.
Dementia friend. A Harpenden Building Society has made a pledge to help to make the town more accommodating to people with dementia. staff from the Nottingham Building Society, which has a branch in Church Green, met with representatives from other local businesses to discuss how to make Harpenden a dementia-friendly town. The Nottingham agreed to become a dementia friend as part of a national movement to learn more about dementia and find out how small businesses and organisations can help. This will mean making sure customers with dementia are given plenty of time for their transactions and that their needs are listened to so the service can be as supportive as possible. Assistant Branch Manager Sophie Rowe said, "We're hoping being a dementia friend will inspire the team on a daily basis. Doing something as simple as going through things again if they look puzzled can make a big difference."
My final story is, in my respectful submission, the most important contribution this morning. It concerns our very own charity. St Albans Audio News Charity has been saluted with the MBE equivalent for volunteer groups. Yes, you've guessed it. The St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, and we'll call it SADTN for short, has received the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service after 45 years serving the community. The charity produces a weekly audio programme with 20 key stories from the Hearts Advertiser, features from Hertfordshire Life, interviews, event previews and book reviews. Established nearly half a century ago by a St Albans couple, SADTN is sent out on a memory stick to about 100 local residents and posted on its website. The service is designed for visually impaired people who would like to engage with local news. SADTN Chairman Mr. Rob Pearman said, "Thanks to the many hundreds of volunteer readers, programme producers, copying and distribution teams and other supporters who have ensured over the past 45 years that this vital link for local visually impaired residents has held to its original aim whilst expanding its content and its outreach." He said, "SADTN is now delivered to stroke survivors and people with other limitations who want to," and he quote, "keep in touch with their local community." Rob added, "Our listeners will be delighted with this great honour, and representatives from SADTN visited Buckingham Palace in May to celebrate the award along with the other recipients. There are 280 other charities who also received the award this year. It was introduced in 2002 to celebrate the Queen's Golden Jubilee coronation. Other recipients include an organisation helping people with mental health problems, a mentoring group for children with parents in prison, and volunteers driving caravans to geographically remote locations to be used as a mobile cafe. SADTN will formally receive the award this summer from Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, Mr. Robert Voss."
And some information about a lunchtime recital now by members of Harmony Music, who will give a free lunchtime recital at a St Albans City Centre church next week. Jana Huneker and Paul Guinery are due to perform at the Parish Church of St Peter on Wednesday, June the 19th at 1 p.m. Their programme includes J.S. Bach's Sonata in G Minor, Out of the Cool by Dave Heath, and Sonata Undine by Karl Reinecke. Born in Germany, Jana studied the flute with Avril Williams. In the early 1990s, she played the piccolo in premieres of Stockhausen's opera Dienstag aus Licht. Most recently, Jana co-founded and co-directs the annual course Flute School London, which has made a big splash in the flute world. Paul studied the piano at the Royal College of Music and then read for a degree in modern languages at Queen's College, Oxford. As well as being Harmony Music's regular pianist since 1997, Paul has made solo CD recordings of Rachmaninoff and, more recently, of 20th century English piano music.
Radio listings from Saturday the 15th of June to Friday the 21st of June. For Saturday 15th June, Actor Simon Callow is a champion of Charles Dickens, having played him on numerous occasions, and to mark his own 70th birthday on this day, he is celebrating by presenting a dazzling repertoire of character voices in this 2001 adaptation of Peter Ackroyd's one-man play, The Mystery of Charles Dickens, which documents the author's life. Radio 4 Extra is broadcasting this programme at 6 a.m, 4 p.m, and 4 a.m. on Sunday. On the eve of Father's Day, Classic FM presents highlights of scores of from films about fathers and their children in Saturday Night at the Movies at 5 p.m. Opera 3 on Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m. is Verdi's Un ballo e maschera, a dark comic tale recorded in February by the Welsh National Opera, starring Welsh tenor Gwyn Hughes-Jones and American soprano Mary Elizabeth Williams. The story was inspired by the death of King Gustavus III of Sweden, who was assassinated at a masked ball in the opera house he himself had built. At 8 p.m, Radio 4's Archive on 4 is Speaking Truth to Power. Mark Darcy takes a historic look at how MPs select committees, comprising a minimum of 11 members, who decide upon the line of inquiry and then gather written and oral evidence, have increasingly come to challenge the powerful. For Sunday 16th June, at 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4, Lauren Laverne's guest castaway on Desert Island Discs is Nitin Sawhney, musician, producer and composer. The Food and Farming Awards are presented by Sheila Dinnan and celebrated over two programmes on Radio 4 today at 12:30 p.m. and tomorrow at 3:30 p.m. These awards are highly regarded in the food industry, as they have previously discovered new talents like Delia Smith and Neil's Yard and championed people who produce great food but are not receiving media cover. The Archers is celebrating this week as the actress who plays Peggy Archer herself turns 100 years old. June Spencer has played the part of Peggy since 1951, and her co-stars have been paying tribute to her this week. The Archers is broadcast every weekday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. and on Sunday at 7 p.m. on Radio 4. At 5 p.m. on Radio 3, the Listening Service presents Better Than Background Music, which investigates how concert hall staples such as Peer Gynt, with origins as incidental music in the theatre, have transcended their original function.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. The Book of the Week this week on Radio 4 FM at 9:45 a.m. is Deaf Republic, an adaptation of Ukrainian-American Ilya Kaminsky's new book of poetry. The first edition is a profile of the author, with contributions from him and others, such as Andrew Motion. The 15-minute drama on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. and repeated at 7:45 p.m. is Lullaby. As part of the Reading Europe strand, Franco-Moroccan writer Leila Slimani's 2016 novel Chanson Douce is translated by Sam Taylor and adapted for radio by Hattie Naylor. A couple become increasingly dependent on their nanny until their idyllic domesticity is shattered. Composer of the Week this week on Radio 3 is Jacques Offenbach, 1819 to 1880, and begins with exploring how the maestro behind the Can-Can launched his own theatre company. At 12:04 p.m. on Radio 4, How to Find Home by Mazuda Snaith continues this week. The weekly concerts begin on Radio 3 at 1 p.m. and then at 2 p.m. Radio 3 in concert at 7:30 p.m. moves to 7 p.m. on Thursday, when it covers the final of the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World 2019, and then reverts to 7:30 p.m. on Friday for Opera on 3. The Full Works concert to continue at 8 p.m. on Classic FM. A new series of Nature Bang begins this week on Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. The presenters examine the science behind phenomena in the natural world and ask whether it can be applied to humans. They begin by looking at how starlings avoid crashing into one another during murmurations, comparing it with the patterns of interaction on social media. On Radio 3 at 10:45 p.m, the essay presents masculinity, the first of five talks on aspects of maleness recorded in front of an audience at the York Festival of Ideas. This episode explores the world of Georgian personal grooming.
And some picks for each day from Monday to Friday. It's for Monday, the 17th of June. Monday's picks are strangely also listed as part of the previous section for daily programmes. So, moving on to Tuesday, June the 18th. The fifth and final episode of The Wreath Lectures is on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. This episode, Shifting the Foundations, addresses the question of a UK written constitution. At 11 o'clock in the morning, Names in the Sky is a programme marking Children's Hospice Week and was made at Tí Hafan in the Vale of Glamorgan. Sound artist Justin Wigan sets out to create a sonic memory garden at the hospice, interspersed with testimony of families whose lives have brought them to Tí Hafan, and it evokes the many aspects of its special character, by no means all of them sombre. Front Row, on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m, is the first of a series about the contenders for Museum of the Year. Moving on to Wednesday, June 19th, on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. and 8:45 p.m, BBC Today programme presents Nick Robinson's podcast. It invites a leading politician to talk about beliefs and principles. That should be a laugh a minute. At 11:30 a.m, Leg Breakers is a new series of three parts. This episode is Inspection and is a comedy drama by Tom Wainwright, set in a struggling stage school and following the fortunes of the principal, Bridget, and her pupils. The 2:15 p.m. drama today is The Cyprus Missing. Set in London in 2014, Althea, a Greek Cypriot woman, seeks answers in her past, including what happened to her father, who disappeared during the 1974 Cyprus conflict. He was left behind when the family fled to London. Moneybox Live on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. helps to answer any financial questions. On the BBC World Service at 3:05 p.m, The Evidence investigates vaccination as its topic, with all the successes but also with people's reluctance to take up the offer of vaccines. The fifth instalment of John Finnemore's Souvenir Programme is on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. The sketch show features guidance on etiquette and the devastating consequences of world peace. The Origin of Stuff with Katie Brand is at 9 p.m. on Radio 4, and this episode investigates the fork. Today's episode of Radio 3 in Concert is highlighted as it showcases Mark Simpson, a composer and clarinetist who won both BBC Young Musician of the Year and BBC Soloist at tonight's premiere of his own clarinet concerto, and in his role as composer with a BBC Philharmonic with whom he plays this evening.
And for Thursday, the 20th of June, on Radio 4 Extra at 11:15 a.m. and 9:15 p.m, The Whitsun Weddings refers to Philip Larkin's poem of the same name and is based on a railway journey he took in the 1950s. A passenger becomes aware of a stream of newlyweds joining the train. Eileen Atkins stars as Audrey in this 1999 verse drama by Kathleen Jamie, interspersed with lines from Larkin's work, who wonders what has become of four of the couples. At 3 p.m. in Ramblings on Radio 4, Claire Balding joins a Dutch family for a ramble in Dorset. And the film programme on Radio 4 at 4pm is from Lapland, where the Festival of the Midnight Sun takes place at a time of the year where it never gets dark and films are shown 24 hours a day. Then in the bottom line at 8:30pm, Evan Davis explores whether people involved in crime have a lot in common with high risk takers in business and discusses the links with guests. Moving on to Friday the 21st of June, at 11am on Radio 4FM, a new series of Science and Religion begins with an examination of the history of the extent of the conflict between science and religion. Nick Spencer draws on the expertise of various academics to explore what the relationship says about what it means to be human. And The Verb on Radio 3 at 10pm examines the often overlooked and unloved word nice. Ian McMillan and guests debate.
Right, well, it seems only last week I was previewing this, but the International Organ Festival has come round again. So let's run through the programme. First thing to do is tell you how you can book. And everything I'm going to talk about can be booked either on the telephone, and that's St Albans, that's 01727 846 126, or in person at the Visitors' Centre box office in the St Albans Cathedral shop. Now, I hope by the time the festival starts, they'll have got the entrance sorted out at the moment. It's quite a lengthy trek zigzagging around because you can only go in and out of the west end of the cathedral. You could up to at least last week. So that's how you book. So let's get started. And I'm going to do this purely sort of chronologically. So I'll pick up on a theme on the festival, preview it for the first time it arises, then follow that theme through. Actually, the first thing we'll be talking about is the fringe events. And there's a huge diversity of excellent music, they say, with lots of different opportunities and venues. And the first, well, it's certainly different and diverse, it's a performer called Dennis Teeth, who performs on a musical saw. And he'll be performing free of charge from noon to 3pm on Wednesday the 3rd of July. And that gets the International Organ Festival off to a flying start. Then we have part of the St Michael's Folk Evening, a Sambuca evening with a Sambuca band. And they'll be performing in front of Verulamium Museum, also on the 3rd of July. And that'll be from 8 to 9:30 in the evening, and it's free. And, of course, that same evening, there is a lot of folk dancing in St Michael's, up and down the road there, all the way between the museum and the Pudding Stone, mostly in the evening, and it will finish at 10:30pm. We then have an open mic session with Pete Sutton, and that's going to be in the Farmer's Boy, and that's on London Road. That's the pub on London Road. Thursday, the 4th of July, we have Big Owl and the Blistering Buicks. And that's going to be rocking oldies and country music in the Farmer's Boy from 9 to 11pm, and it's free. And also on Thursday the 4th, we have Oka Vanga, which is a folk and roots duo, and they'll be performing at the Redbourne Folk Club in the Hollybush Church End in Redbourne, and that's 8 to 10:45pm. That's paid concert, that'll cost you £9. Saturday the 6th of July, there is a street party hosted by the Blue Angel Acoustic Cafe, and that's going to be all over the city centre from noon to 4pm, and it's free. Lots of musicians out and about there. Sunday the 7th of July, we have the Vintage Dance Organ. That's an exhibit from the St Albans Organ Theatre. It's a 1929 Mortier dance organ, and it's going to be positioned outside the clock tower from noon to 3pm. Then we have Gary and Dave's Nashville Skyline, a Dylan-esque country folk performance in the Farmer's Boy at 9 to 11pm, and that's free. Then we have Monday the 8th of July through to Thursday the 11th, we have performances in Lussman's Restaurant in Heritage Close. They're all at 8pm, they're all free, but I literally don't know whether you're expected to buy a meal or a drink or whatever. I know you can just buy a drink there. Anyway, it's they're jazz-themed concerts, and this first one on from, or the first group of them from the 8th to 11th, are by the Barcodes and the Incredible Blue Puppies. Wednesday, the 10th of July, Hugh Barwell, who's an accordionist extraordinaire, will be at the Clock Tower from noon to 3pm, and he's free. Then we have Thursday, the 11th of July, the Free Electric Band in the Farmer's Boy in the evening. That's free. And at Lussman's, we have Mike Gorman from the 12th to the 14th of July, and Ian McKenzie from the 15th to the 17th, and Gareth Hunt from the 18th to the 21st of July. And these are all, well, according to the programme, and I suspect you may know them better than I, quite renowned jazz musicians. Now, Saturday the 13th, we have the Fringe Garden Party. That's going to be in the Vintry Garden, and it's free. So you'll hear lots of different groups performing there and other attractions. And then we have the Summer Garden Party with Stanley D, and that's an 11-piece band playing tribute to Steely Dan. And that's going to be in the Farmer's Boy from 3 to 6pm, and that's free again. So that's looking at the fringe events. So now we'll get down to the more serious music. And we'll start off with the theme of Late Nights by Candlelight. And this is a series of concerts. Tickets are all £18, but restricted views are only £12, and there's a discount if you buy two, three or more of the concert tickets. The first one is on Wednesday the 10th of July. It's at 10pm. I'll repeat that, 10pm. These are all late night events. It's in St Michael's Church, and it's called Guardian Angel by Rachel Podger, who is a solo violinist, and she'll be performing works by Bach, Tartini and Bieber. Then on Thursday the 11th, 10pm in St Michael's Church, this one is called Dream Tryst, Music for a Summer's Night, and it will feature the Choir of King's College London, and they'll be performing works by Holst, Fincy and Rutter, and it says it's a heady collection of secular part songs. Then Thursday the 18th of July, the last in this little season, at 10pm again in St Michael's, two harpsichords will be performing, a tantalising original glimpse into the contrapuntal genius of J.S. Bach, which is the perfect introduction to the next batch of concerts, which is called Bach Corner. Now, the Bach Corner concerts are all free. I think they're all in the cathedral. Let's run through them. Thursday the 11th of July, 1:15pm, and that's given by Callum Alger. All the music's by Bach, fairly obviously, so I won't keep saying that. Friday the 2nd of July, 1:15pm, again in the cathedral, by Henry Websdale. Thursday the 18th of July, 1:15pm, in the cathedral, by Paulina Sosnina. Then Friday the 19th of July, the last in this series, again at 1:15pm, again in the cathedral, we've got Alexander Little. Then we have a Howard Blake 80th birthday celebration concert on Saturday the 13th of July. It'll be at 7:30pm and it's in the cathedral, and it's a performance called Benedictus. And there is quite a battery of choirs of the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, and the St Albans Bach Choir. The Dean of St Albans will be the narrator, and there's various soloists. And the programme will include The Rise of the House of Usher, Walking in the Air, A Speech After a Long Silence, and Songs of Truth and Glory. And Howard Blake, as I'm sure you all know, is one of Britain's best-loved living composers. Now, tickets for that are £30, going down to £12. Now we get to the more serious business of the actual competitions, the jury solo organ recitals. And this is where the panel of judges, who are all outstanding experts and performers in their own field, they showcase their own talents and demonstrate why they're judges. And tickets for their performances are all £15. And the first one of these is on Saturday the 13th of July, 3:30 in the afternoon, in St Peter's Church. And it's Christophe Montou, who is from Paris, an organist from Paris, performing works by Marchand, Boivin, Buxtehude and Bach. Sunday the 14th of July, 3pm in the cathedral, we have Ken Cowan, and he'll be performing works by Berlioz, Whitlock, Bach, Grant Still, Laurin and Dupré. Monday the 15th of July at 1pm, and this is one of the few events which has been outsourced to Spitalfields, so it's quite a trek to get there. But Thomas Trotter from Birmingham will be performing works by Bach, Stanley, Handel, Pepusch, Bach and Russell. Thursday the 18th of July at 6pm, back in St Albans in the cathedral, the Swedish organist Hans Ola Eriksson will be performing works by Bach, Ungvari, Vasks and Messiaen. And then Saturday the 20th of July at 3:30pm in St Peter's Church, Dong Il Shin will be performing works by Gigo, Sweetlink, Vivaldi, Bach, Mozart, Shostakovich and Vienne. On Sunday the 14th, a group called Il Pegaso will be performing, and they're a quintet, and they are a quintet of early music performers. So it's a concert of early music performed on authentic instruments, and there'll be works by Monteverdi and Frescobaldi, amongst others. Tickets for that are £20 or £15. Another quite big event, a three choirs concert. That's on Monday the 15th of July, 7:30pm in the Cathedral, dedicated to the memory of Peter Hurford. And it'll be the choirs of St Albans Cathedral, Jesus College, Cambridge and Salisbury Cathedral. And works being performed will include those by Parry, Hurford himself, Schutz, Joubert, Leighton, Jacob and Walton. Tickets for that are £32 down to £15. Then we have a poetry event on Tuesday the 16th of July, 8:30pm, again in the Cathedral. It's T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, and the narrator is going to be Simon Callow, the actor, but he'll be supported by the Carducci String Quartet. So there'll be appropriate music being played alongside the poems, particularly by Beethoven. Tickets for that are just one price at £20. And there's a very different sort of event on Wednesday the 17th of July at 9:30pm in the Cathedral, and it's entitled The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Now, this is a very famous silent film, but the evening is about organ and live electronic music that was composed to go with the film, the organ music, not the live electronic music. And it's been performed by Franz Danksar-Müller, who is a professor of music at Lübeck. There will be a showing of the silent film, but the main part of the evening is the music. Tickets for that are just one price at £18. Then we have the concerto final, and that's going to be on Friday the 19th of July. It's at 7:30pm in the Cathedral. There, it'll be supported by the St James Baroque, and you'll be able to hear the three finalists performing, and they'll be performing work entirely by Handel. Tickets to hear the finalists will be £25 or £15. Then on Saturday the 20th of July at 1pm, we have a song recital in the Assembly Room at St Albans Museum and Gallery. And it's entitled If Music Be the Food of Love... And it's performed by Catherine Wynne Rogers and Anna Tilbrook on the piano. And the works will include works by Britten, Purcell, Vaughan Williams, Gurney, Fincy and Quilter. Tickets for that will be £20 or £15. And finally, we come to the actual competitions, you might call in some ways the whole point of it all, and that's going to be on Saturday the 20th of July at 7pm, actually in the Abbey itself, and these are the improvisation and interpretation finals. And tickets to hear that will be all one price, £20. And that's it for another 2 years. And in 2 years' time, I hope I'll be back previewing another International Organ Festival.
My guest in the studio today is Sian Tomlinson, who has been with Mind in Mid Hearts for about 10 years, I think.
That's right, yes.
But in the last 3 years, you've been CEO.
Yes.
So that's your responsibility. Mm. And Mind in Mid Hearts is based in St Albans, but also...
in Stevenage, Welwyn Garden City and Hertford. And we do outreach services in North Hearts and Harpenden and Roundabout as well. So if people can't get to one of our centres, they should contact us and we will try and get out to them.
If you can sum up very briefly what you do. I mean, obviously Mind in Mid Hearts is linked with Mind, which is a national name. You're an affiliate. Is that the right terminology?
So National Mind gets involved in things like research, campaigning, reducing the stigma of mental health. They lobby the government. And Mind in Mid Hearts and all the local minds across England and Wales, there's about 140, they deliver services. So National Mind don't deliver any services. Local minds will be the ones that will actually see people and help them on their journey. And there's three main themes to the work that we do. One is prevention. One is social support for people with long-term conditions. And the third one is obviously around recovery, whatever that means to the individual. That could mean just coming in to do a course on managing anxiety or coping with depression, or it could be a social support group to make new contacts, maybe build their confidence up to be social again after a spate of being unwell. And they're all very much overlap, the themes in terms of recovery and management and social support and prevention. They all really meet together. And we offer counselling, so individual counselling for people. We run a variety of different interventions that people might find helpful.
What makes people come to you?
We have a hospital discharge service, so we actually visit people while they're in hospital to really bridge inpatient to outpatient care and to make sure that when they're in hospital, they understand what's available in the community so that when they come out, they're already, you know what's going to be available and what support they can get. And then obviously people come to see us who are stressed or unwell and they want some support. A lot of the GPs will say, have you contacted Mind? Do you know about Mind? So that's generally why people come to see us and why I love opportunities to come and talk on the radio like today, because I want people to know that actually you don't have to be unwell. We want people to come and see us before they become unwell. If we can prevent somebody from becoming unwell, we'd really love to get that chance. And I think the counselling works for that. People can come just for a one-off consultation about something that they're finding tricky. Maybe you're coming up to retirement, or maybe you're having a baby and you're just feeling a bit anxious and nervous. Don't ignore those early signs. Come and talk to somebody, and they may only need one session, and that might help them to feel a little bit more confident about these life transitions, which are major stuff for people, but often can be the trigger to them feeling unwell. And that can, if they don't get the right support and help, that ends up with they need medication or they need some more specialist support.
In a way, what you're saying is almost a sort of parallel to physical
exactly.
health.
National Mind often talk about parity of esteem and that commissioners should be spending as much money on mental health as they are on physical health, which at the moment about 25% of the NHS budget goes on mental health and 75% goes on physical health. I don't know that they'll change that dramatically, but we want people to understand that if somebody collapses in the road and they're not well mentally, somebody doesn't say pull yourself together and get up. As if you were to fall over in the street or trip up and break your leg, nobody would say, oh, come on, pull yourself together, get up. So we want the same respect and acknowledgement for mental health as people have for physical health. And we want people to look after their mental health just like they do their physical health. They think about their diet, they think about exercise. We want people to think about their mental health in the same way. What can I do to stay well? So the Mental Health Foundation did a lot of research and they published that research. It's all available online. If people Google the Mental Health Foundation, they will see the 5 ways to well-being. And it was proven that by practicing those 5 ways to well-being, just like you've got to eat your 5 fruit and veg a day, you've got to practice these things. And they are just simple and easy things to practice.
Give me one example. Like what?
So the 5 things are giving, take notice, keep learning, stay connected, and exercise. None of it has to be major. Exercise could be running up the stairs instead of taking the lift, could be walking to the next bus stop instead of getting on the bus at your nearest bus stop. Just staying active, going for a walk. It can mean staying connected, can mean make that phone call that you keep meaning to make, that old friend that you haven't stayed connected with. Stay connected to your friends and family. And giving, of course, that's easy. You can do both of those at the same time, because if you make that phone call, chances are your friend or your family member who hasn't heard from you is going to be delighted. So you've given something and you've stayed connected. And then, of course, taking notice. That can be just noticing the birds are singing, or it can be noticing how you're feeling. Sometimes it gets to 12 o'clock and I think, do you know, I haven't even stopped for a drink today. So it's stopping, thinking, oh, do I need a glass of water? Do I need to have a 5-minute break from what I'm doing at the moment? And keeping learning. I mean, if anybody's listening to this, they've solved that one today because they're learning by listening to this today. So these aren't, you know, rocket science. These are really easy things to do. And if people practice them, it's the way of staying mentally well.
The image that people have of mental health is somebody who is mentally ill, somebody who has really serious problems. And what you're saying here is that actually you're describing a situation that we're all in.
The thing is that we do try and always separate mental health and physical health, but actually they're very overlapped. And all the research now is looking at how staying physically well and physically active actually really improves people's mental health. And people's mental health, if they stay fit mentally, will actually really help them to stay physically well as well. Because, you know, we do hold a lot of stress in our bodies. So if we learn ways of managing stress, the chances are our physical health will improve too.
Let's take an example. Somebody comes to you and they know that they have reached a point where the stress is getting on top of them, whether it's stress related to work or stress in family relationships or whatever it may be. What do they get from you? They knock on the door and say, I want some help. How does it work?
They would come in and they would fill in a form, and there's like a little tick box of lots of things that we offer, and they can tick what they see on there that they think they might be interested in. We would then invite them in for a meeting, because they can fill that form in online, or we can post them a form, or they can drop into the office and fill the form in. That just gives us a starting point to talk. And then what we would be wanting to know is, what would they be hoping for from coming to see us? Perhaps they had financial difficulties. Then we might signpost them. We might be supportive in helping them go to the CAB. Could be that they're a bit anxious about going to the citizens' advice. We would just help them again bridge that gap between what we do and what other people do. Make sure they get the right advice they need for their finances, their benefits. If you're feeling vulnerable, it can be really hard to tell somebody that you've got financial difficulties. But if through that first meeting they come in and they say, well, you know, feeling very stressed, we might be able to get to the bottom of it and then signpost them to get the right support and advice that they need, or come in and see us if they're having some relationship difficulties. It could be that they need counselling or want counselling. It could be that maybe just talking about it is enough. Having one session, coming and talking to somebody, having a consultation can be just suddenly you think, oh, well, maybe I can find my way through this. That's what we would do.
Who would they be talking to?
We have a project officer and we have support workers, and they are qualified mental health workers, and they would be seeing one of them, either a senior support worker or our project officer. So we've got a project officer in each centre. We've got one here in St Albans, one in Welland, one in Hartford, or one of the senior support workers.
And behind the project officer, then there are counsellors that yeah. are professional?
We've got 25 counsellors working across a wide range of different modalities. So people might be unaware that different people work different ways. So we have CBT therapists, but that doesn't fit for everybody. So cognitive behavioural therapy looks at how people are thinking, and perhaps if they could change their perspective, that might change about how they're feeling about things. Then we'd have like a psychodynamic therapist who's very much interested in perhaps what happened in somebody's childhood, how they learnt to be a human being in this world, what maybe roles they saw other people playing, and maybe those were good for them at one time in their life, but they're not serving them well now. So they might want to look at those and think, how can I change the way I think about that and give myself new choices? So I see counselling being about giving people more choices about how to live their life in a really healthy way. And then we have person-centred counsellors who are very much just listeners. They are very much listening to what somebody has to say rather than giving any direction. If somebody just feels like they need to have somebody to talk to, then a person-centred approach would work for that. But then you hear people say, well, all the counsellor did was sit and listen, and that wasn't very helpful. So then we would want to give them something a little bit more director. So the first meeting is actually also looking at that. What kind of talking is going to be helpful? And it could be that joining an art group would be more helpful. Actually just being with people who maybe might be like-minded, might also be struggling a little bit with their health and their stress levels, and actually just sitting in a room and chatting about the weather and doing a bit of art might be all you need just to relieve the stress, to be thinking about something else. But we also do things like mindfulness, and we have women's only groups, we have men's only groups. We run a whole variety of things. Art's very popular.
What
so we
is that?
Run. I think because, you know, we often forget about how creative we can be. We're so fixated on being productive without thinking that art can just be fun. We don't have to be Picasso. And so actually just getting people in touch with their own creativity can be really meaningful when people have perhaps forgotten about being creative. You know, we live our lives being productive, doing work and earning money and making ends meet. I'm not saying those things are wrong, but sometimes when people are feeling very stressed, actually just remembering what fun it can be to be creative can really be life enhancing.
And you talked about having women's groups and men's groups. How many people might that be?
We try not to get the groups too big because sometimes people find that overwhelming. So they're normally no more than 12. If they get really popular, we might stretch it more than that. But quite often they're 6 or 8.
People sit around and talk about their own problems, is that?
We tend to talk about whatever's going on for them at the moment. And generally the leader would give them a theme. What are people doing around exercise or nutrition or something like that? So we try and keep it quite optimistic and positive. If people need to talk about their problems, sometimes that can be better done on a one-to-one basis. Sometimes they do talk about the problems because sometimes people don't want to feel like they're the only one that has problems, and that can be quite helpful. We let people very much lead the group, but the leader would be looking at trying to maintain some healthy aspect to it so that it doesn't just become everybody making everybody else unhappy.
You've talked about 25 counsellors.
We do have some paid counsellors, but the majority of our counsellors are volunteers. Some of them are on placement, so some of them are training. We don't accept anybody in their first 2 years of training, so everybody will be at least in their third year, and then we obviously will supervise all of those counsellors. We don't charge. We say people can pay what they can afford, and some people can pay £2. So it's a very low cost service, which does mean we've got a bit of a waiting list because obviously there's a lot of people out there who can't afford private therapy, and there's a limited amount on the NHS that you can get. So people are very happy to come to us, but they probably will have to wait a bit. Not for a consultation, like we would call a consultation being just coming to talk about one thing, but if they need counselling over a period of weeks, then they would need to wait for that. Staff-wise, we've got about 38 members of staff. Quite a lot of those are part-time. Some of them are sessional workers, and we really rely on our volunteers who support those groups that we were talking about, the arts and crafts groups. They're often led by volunteers. People come in, they help us with admin, they perhaps will answer the telephone, they will lead support groups, as well as the counselling. So obviously all our trustees are all volunteers. So we have about 100 volunteers at the moment across our four centres. And what can be really valuable is having volunteers with lived experience. So we do encourage people who have used our services to volunteer, because that can be really helping somebody who's perhaps doesn't feel they can recover, perhaps feels in quite a dark place, and then to meet somebody who's been there can be really helpful.
And you're providing what is either a free service or can be a very low cost service to the user. How are your funds?
About half of our funding comes from what's called integrated commissioning, which is Herts County Council. So some of that money comes from health and some of it comes from the County Council, which is local taxpayers. The other half of our funding is coming from a variety of places. Some grants that we've applied for. So we have a grant from the Lloyds Bank Foundation, various different grant funders. Henry Smith, probably the general public haven't heard of these people, but I mentioned the Lloyds Bank because they would remember that one. And then smaller grants and fundraising. We do quite a lot of fundraising. And we're very lucky that sometimes big businesses, like at the moment, Morgan Sindel, who's next door and is building at the moment, redeveloping the old museum, they came to see us and they said, well, you know, as we're making a lot of noise and inconveniencing you, maybe we could support you as a charity. And so they made us their charity of the year. So then they'll do various things throughout the year, which will raise money for us.
You've got a waiting list.
Yes.
So that means that you haven't got either enough room, enough people, or enough cash.
We don't have enough room. The rent here is very high. You can imagine in St. Albans City Centre. We feel we need to be in city centres so that we are as accessible as possible. We don't want people to have to get two buses to get to us. So funding is always an issue. We would love to have more space. If we had more space, I think we could double what we do here in St. Albans.
Could you get the professionals and the volunteers to cope with that?
Oh, yes. We were very fortunate. I think because we do a good service, people really like coming to us. They really like working for us and they really like volunteering for us. We're very fortunate. People aren't the problem. It's the money and the space. Quite a lot of people who come and see us actually give us a donation, quite a substantial donation, just because they're grateful for what they've received. It's really heartwarming. Sometimes it's the small donations that actually mean the most.
You're dealing with people of all ages. You've mentioned people who might be working with students smoking in schools. Do you deal with children?
No, 16 and over. We do have a family therapy clinic on a Saturday morning, but that's in Stevenage, and we would see families with children. We would work with children in schools. We're very happy to go in and do assemblies and talk about mental health, and again, just really encourage children to talk and not to bottle things up. The rate of self-harm in England is the highest in Europe. So our young people are struggling out there and there just isn't enough services for them. So although we're not children orientated in terms of helping them recover from mental health issues, again, we want to work on the prevention stuff. So we'll go into schools and do talks. And we're also part of a Spot the Signs, Save a Life campaign, which is a suicide prevention service, which again is training in schools and colleges. And also in any organisation that asks us, we'll go along and do Spot the Signs training. So it's really getting people to talk about suicide, because sometimes people are frightened that if they mention the word, it might make it happen, where actually the opposite is true. The more we talk about suicide, the less likely it is to happen. People will bottle things up. And when you say to somebody, you know, are you thinking of hurting yourself, or do you think you'd be better off dead? The relief on their faces just to have somebody who's brave enough to mention it and they can talk about it, and you're preventing it from happening then, because they bottle it up and think nobody cares. So we just want to make sure that nobody thinks that's the only way out. We want to make sure that everybody in Hertfordshire understands that there is somebody who does care and who will listen. So the Spot the Signs is all about just encouraging people to talk about suicide, spotting the signs in case we think somebody might be having suicidal thoughts, and what they should do if they do spot the signs. And that training is free. The NHS are leading on it. So that training is available across Hertfordshire. So anybody who would like to do that, there are open courses which people can just sign up for, or if they work for an organisation that would like us to come in and deliver that, we'll deliver deliver anywhere, in businesses, in corporations, in St Albans Council, wherever they are, we'll come. And particularly, obviously, we've been very successful in delivering that with voluntary services because those volunteers and their staff are very keen to have that training. But we really want to get out to everybody. The campaign's been going for about 4 years. We targeted GPs first because the research shows that people who take their own life, something like 80% of those people saw their GP in the 2 weeks before they took their own life. So we targeted GPs to spot the signs.
I know from looking at your website, you've got a whole lot of services, and we've only, in a sense, only touched on some of them. So
yes.
I would certainly encourage people to go to the website and see the whole range of things.
Yes,
and then
do.
To get in contact with you if they feel that any of it's relevant to them.
Absolutely.
A lot of what you have to do, you just mentioned sort of reaching out in different ways. You have to reach out all the time to keep saying, we're here, there are these services available.
Yeah.
They're not going to cost you an arm and a leg. You've got a week coming up, I think a national week, is it? What's going to happen?
Absolutely. Mental Health Awareness Week is the 14th to the 19th of May, and the theme for this year is stress, so it's very relevant for what I've been talking around, prevention rather than cure. The Mental Health Foundation started Mental Health Awareness a few years ago, and they are a very good organisation for people to look at if they want to access some support online, where they just want to read about mental health conditions or they want to know what the latest research is saying. The Mental Health Foundation website's very informative.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Now, if you want to find out more about Mind in Mid-Hearts, you can go to their website, which is mindinmidhearts.org.uk. Now, Mind in Mid-Hearts is just one word. That's the website. Email address is admin@mindinmidhearts.org.uk. And if you want the telephone number, it's the St Albans office, 01727 865070, and they can redirect you to any one of their offices because they have offices in Stevenage, Welwyn Garden City and Hartford.
It knocks the last breath out of him. He thinks it may be his last. His forehead returns to the ground. He lies waiting for Walter to jump on him. The dog, Bella, is barking, shut away in an outhouse. "I'll miss my dog," he thinks. The yard smells of beer and blood. Someone is shouting down on the riverbank. Nothing hurts. Or perhaps it's that everything hurts because there is no separate pain that he can pick out. But the cold strikes him, just in one place, just through his cheekbone as it rests on the cobbles. "Look now! Look now!" Walter bellows. He hops on one foot as if he's dancing. "Look what I've done! Burst my boot, kicking your head!"
So that was part of the very early section of Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. And Camilla Chester is here with me to discuss it. She read it. It's a long book.
Yeah, it certainly is.
And she may never get to read the sequel because that's just as long. And there's a third one on the way because, of course, Hilary Mantel won the Booker Prize in 2009 with Wolf Hall. And then 3 years later, she won it again with Bring Up the Bodies.
Yeah.
So she's trying to space it out so she can get three of them under her belt. But it's fairly complex in many, many ways because it's historical. And if you don't know a great deal about the Tudors, no doubt it's quite confusing. So let's set the scene. We're going to be talking about Thomas Cromwell more than anything else, I suspect, because it's about him, the young boy that we saw just being kicked by his father, if you like, becomes a very powerful man because he's both clever, very good at what he does. I mean, he escapes from his father, effectively goes abroad with the help of some Dutch, as far as I remember, cloth people in the cloth business,
yeah,
whatever
textiles,
else.
Yeah.
Then he joins the army, becomes a fighter. Then he comes back and he starts to build his political position with, well, not initially, but eventually with Cardinal Wolsey, who was a key figure. So let's get the history straight. Here we are. Henry VIII. Everybody knows he had six wives. That was the problem with the whole thing. And he had, first of all, married his brother's widow. His brother died before he took the throne. So Henry VIII, for whatever reason, he is said at one point in there to have fallen in love with this woman, though she was older than him, of course. But in order to marry his wife, he had to prove to the church in Rome and the Pope, that he was allowed to do that. And the only way he could do that was to get what was called a dispensation, which said, actually, yes, as she said, she'd never slept with her first husband, so she was okay. She could marry his brother. That's where we start. Now, the problem for Henry is that having done that, the queen does not produce an heir, and he falls out of love with her, and the woman he really wants to sleep with won't sleep with him unless she becomes queen. It all gets a bit complicated. And into this world steps Thomas Cromwell. Not, of course, Oliver Cromwell. We've got to be careful not to get the two names confused. This is Thomas Cromwell.
Very different people.
Very different time. Now, Cromwell has had a hard childhood. I think you felt that quite good writing at the beginning.
Yeah, oh yeah, I thought that was an amazing opening. And I understand that Hilary Mantel herself suffers with chronic pain disorder. So she writes pain very well. And I think that opening shows us what sort of tough beginning Thomas has and a little bit about how he is so resilient and strong and so open to anything that might improve his life. And so that's why, while he's abroad, he takes every opportunity he can and will learn and learn and learn. So he learns different languages, different cultures. He seems to pick up nuances and he gets very skilled in dealing with different characters from all different sorts of backgrounds. So that stands him in a very good stead and enables him to progress quite quickly in his life.
I mean, Hilary Mantel is creating a character. This is a fiction. It's not actual fact, but it's based on an enormous amount of research, obviously. Yeah. So we don't know if this is the real Cromwell or whether it's Hilary Mantel's Cromwell. But factually, he came from a very poor background, the back streets of Putney, as it then was, where it was pretty tough, and his father was a drunkard and a bully. And there's later suggestions that Cromwell probably did a little bit of knifing in the back while he was around as well to get rid of his enemies or whoever.
Well, that's hinted at all the way through, isn't it? That he's this sort of lovable rogue kind of character, because he's a bit dodgy as well and knows how to cut corners and come up trumps all the way through the book and knows who to back.
His speech is low and rapid, his manner assured. He is at home in courtroom or waterfront, bishop's palace or inn yard. He can draft a contract, train a falcon, draw a map, stop a street fight, furnish a house and fix a jury.
And yet he's quite kind to other people, isn't he?
Yeah, and animals, actually, as well. And she hints about, because his father was a blacksmith and he ruled the horses with fear, Thomas was always the one that calmed the animals. And he has a dog that's mentioned right at the beginning. And every dog he has throughout the book, he always names the dog Bella. And it's in memory, I think, of that first dog that comes to a bit of a sticky end. And the same with people. All the way through, he feels very close to people. He wants to help people. He wants to better people's positions in social standing.
When he becomes successful, he's already relatively old, and certainly in terms of the 16th century. I think he's probably around about 40. I mean, he's been away, he's fought as a soldier, he's come back. He becomes quite successful, but that is partly because he's working for Cardinal Wolsey, who is the king's great favourite for whom everything went wrong, because Wolsey negotiated eventually and was involved in getting this dispensation so that Henry could marry Catherine, his first wife. And then, of course, the king turned on him and said, well, look, it's all your fault. Sounds remarkably like what politicians do most of the time, isn't it?
Yeah, and there are similes all the way through to, like, modern times, and that's quite a lesson for us all, I think, is we sort of look back at this and think, oh, well, they didn't know, it was all in the past, and they're, but of course, that was their present, and for them it's as living their lives just as we are now, and it seemed ironic in so many ways that we don't seem to have learned, and these centuries ago, we're still making similar mistakes. But yes, Henry, driven by his own lust, if you like, and his own greed, wants things to change and is looking for ways to manipulate the world in his own personal favour. And Thomas comes as part of that. But Wolsey, yes, is the one who originally takes Thomas under his wing.
I often wonder about the monastic ideal, especially as applied to the young. My servant Cromwell, for instance, his youth was secluded, spent almost entirely in fasting, prayer, and the study of the Church Fathers. That's why he's so wild nowadays. And when people say, is he? Recalling as best they can a man who seems peculiarly discreet. When they say, really? Your man Cromwell? The Cardinal will shake his head and say, but I try to mend matters, of course. When he breaks the windows, we just call in the glaziers and part with the cash. As for the procession of aggrieved young women, Poor creatures, I pay them off.
He effectively acts as his sort of secretary, but he's also used, he gets information. He says at one stage, you know, my job isn't to upset my boss, if you like, but it's to keep him informed, know what's going on.
Yes.
Because the cardinal often is unaware of quite, there's such a devious court. Yes. I mean, there's so much trickery going on there because it was families battling for power.
Yes.
The Boleyn family comes in and because they've got their agenda. Then there's later there's the Seymour family and the others. And sometimes they lose out badly because they get their heads chopped off for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Cromwell is also very supportive and very kind in many ways to his mentor, to the cardinal.
Yes.
Although he knows the cardinal's going down, he doesn't abandon him.
No, he stays very loyal to him. So he's not looking out for himself. He's staying very loyal to somebody who's become a close friend. And he may not agree with everything that the cardinal stands for, but he certainly respects him and doesn't agree with the way that things have turned on him and stays very loyal to him. And actually that stands him in good stead later on. Because, of course, the king notices that and notices that quality in him, that loyalty. And when you're surrounded by people who you're suspicious of, which the king was known to be very highly suspicious of everybody, he learns to trust Cromwell because Cromwell has earned that. It's an interesting tale of twists and turns.
You would almost think that the way that somebody succeeds, and again, let's think about contemporary politicians or more recent politicians, that often the way they succeed is by being quite tricky with other people. I mean, not caring about anybody else. It is them first, whatever happens, even if the country goes down pan, as it were. It's the individual's own career is more important to him or her than anything else. It's this odd thing, isn't it? He's very successful. I mean, throughout the book, he is rising.
Yeah.
And he goes on rising through the next book. His demise will only come in the third book, which hasn't been written yet.
He identifies his enemies, doesn't he? And he knows who is a potential threat to him. And he deals with it really wily. And he often lavishes gifts on people and flatters people and sort of charms his way. Even though physically he's often described to be not very pleasing to the eye, if you like, and be quite gruff and fierce looking. And certainly with his rough upbringing, it's made him very tough. But yet he still seems to know what to say and in what language to say it and in order to win people over.
Well, that's right. There are various key characters and I can't remember the name because there are so many names in the book. You'd have to have a little list of them to remember who we're talking about. But one of the dukes who has been involved in the downfall of Wolsey, the cardinal, also realises this guy Cromwell's quite interesting and could be useful. And he almost offers him an opportunity, you know, and he's maybe acting for the king, we're not sure perhaps at that stage, but that ability to, he's a very rounded character as a result of that, isn't it? And everything is sort of in the present, isn't it? Something you said earlier, that we look back at it and we should have learned, but actually they don't know what's coming ahead, of course, but it's very complex where they are and they're looking all sides of it.
Well, I think in the beginning of the book, we start with him being a child and then we go forwards in time, don't we, to when he's there beside the cardinal. And then we go back again and there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing in the very first part of the book and that can be a little bit confusing. She uses a lot of flashback technique and retelling of a story. But once we see the demise of the cardinal, we then pick up the story in a linear fashion and that makes it slightly easier to follow because it's just the next day and we're not doing so much jumping around. There is a little bit when he's reflecting on things, but certainly it makes it a little bit easier to follow. And I think she had to do that because at that point you've got the court involved and then you've got the layers of all the different people, political people, whereas before we were a little bit more just concerned with his family, his wife and his children and his life with them serving the cardinal. But once he gets closer and closer to the king, it becomes more complicated and we have to follow it a bit more carefully.
And he comes up against Sir Thomas More, who refuses to go along with getting rid of the first queen in order to have the second one. And there's this whole sort of theological argument and the political argument.
That's right, loyal to the church,
He never sees More, a star in another firmament, who acknowledges him with a grim nod, without wanting to ask him, what's wrong with you? Or what's wrong with me? Why does everything you know and everything you've learned confirm you in what you believed before? Whereas in my case, what I grew up with and what I thought I believed is chipped away a little and a little, a fragment, then a piece, and then a piece more. With every month that passes, the corners are knocked off the certainties of this world and the next world too.
And Moore is certainly not a very nice figure, really, and responsible for a lot of suffering.
He's as devious and nasty as the rest of them.
Some of the things that people are subjected to for their beliefs is really quite shocking. The sort of torture is described and the conditions that the people are kept in just for speaking out about what they believed in. And I think that's Cromwell's main issue with him and why they come to loggerheads, certainly in Mantell's telling of this story.
Because he pretends to be a very pious man.
Yes.
And Mantell rather puts him down and saying, well, you know, always, well, why didn't he become a priest then? The answer, because he was too much lusting after the women.
Yeah.
he will have his comeuppance as well, because he's got problems ahead, because he will not go along with the king. And the king does not forgive somebody who will not help him to achieve what he wants.
And of course he does. We all know from history that he gets what he wants.
Yeah.
And he gets to marry the woman that he wants to.
Of course, he will always argue his job was to produce an heir, son and heir.
Yeah.
A legitimate one. He'd produced a few others that were not legitimate, but he wanted and needed a young man to sit on the throne. He eventually got one, but he would argue it's part of what he was doing, but there's always a solid political reason. And of course, it leads us into the Reformation, because you've got Luther out in Germany writing all these documents which were against the Pope and against the Catholic Church, and eventually Henry reckons that's the side to be on as well.
Yeah.
He moves over and takes control of the church against Rome.
It is very complex, because you're mixing everything, aren't you? You're mixing human desire and need. You're mixing that with leadership, with what the country is demanding, changing of who owns what, and also political and religious beliefs are changing. And it's difficult, like always, to find the right answer to it. And he's trying to be a leader. And he doesn't come across as being nasty in any way, really, Henry VIII. He just is another figure in all of it. And she portrays him as really quite regal. And the way Thomas admires him, he admires the way he holds himself, the way he speaks, a lot of the things that he does. He spends a lot of time hunting and that sort of stuff. And Thomas is certainly admiring of that. They all kept saying, pick your prince, didn't they? And you pick your prince that you're going to follow. And he picks Henry as the man that he's going to follow and be loyal to, even after what Henry did to the cardinal. So it's a difficult book to follow, definitely. If you're not picking up on all the details, don't worry too much about that. I certainly didn't. There was a lot that went over my head, and I read a lot. And also, it's not a particularly familiar time in history for me. I don't study history, but that doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the book. And it does open your eyes to a lot of things that might be current now. And also just admiring her technique as a writer, really very skillful. I liked the way that she would remind us about the way Cromwell looked. And there's a particular chapter when he has a painting done and presented to him. And when that's described, we get so caught up in a lot of the political turmoil and who's trying to outdo who and all the backstabbing that's going on, that you can miss the central character sometimes. So we're reminded in that chapter, we know what he actually looked like and how he came across to other people. So I really enjoyed reading that.
He sees his painted hand resting on the desk before him, holding a paper in a loose fist. It is uncanny, as if he had been pulled apart, to look at himself in sections, digit by digit. Hans has made his skin smooth as the skin of a courtesan, but the motion he has captured, that folding of the fingers, is as sure as that of a slaughterman's when he picks up the killing knife.
He's about a person, very rounded and interesting character.
Yeah,
that's why I liked it most, I think.
Yeah, I think that's why I enjoyed it most. A lot of contemporary fiction that we're given is often spoon-fed to us, and we don't have to work particularly hard in reading it. And sometimes there's merit in actually challenging yourself and maybe making yourself read something that you wouldn't normally, and it's a bit out of your comfort zone. It's not an easy read. You're not going to just pick it up and fly through it. It took me a long time to read it, but I think it's worth it. I'm really glad that I did and persevered to the end.
Thank you very much. Camilla Chester and I have been discussing Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. It was read on this recording by Terence Hardiman. The audiobook runs for 25 hours. As ever, we're grateful to Caliber Audio for permission to use extracts in our discussion.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Anna, Jenny, Martin and Lucy. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme. But that's all from me, Bill Redway, in June 2019. We close with the Honeybee Slip Jig by Corrida. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.